This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is suggested for the following World Wrestling Federation event.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 29 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, for the second part of the Fortnight of Funk, we're taking a look at the Saturday Night's Main Event from January 4, 1986, and Terry Funk's most high-profile singles match in the WWF, at least for that particular run in 1985 and 86, as he is facing off against world champion Hulk Hogan in the main event of the Saturday Night's Main Event show. Of course, it's in the middle of the program. That's how they did things on Saturday Night's Main Event, was your main event would generally be at the beginning or usually the second match, because if it's airing at 11:30 p.m. on the East Coast in the United States, you have to get those viewers in then and then hope that they hang on until 1 a.m., when the show is over. So enough about that. Just a few quick plugs. You can reach me via email, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. On Twitter, where I have been quite active lately with my footnotes after I post the show on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, at GF Allentown Pod. I am on Facebook as GF Allentown. And do check out the Place to Be Nation at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. You can make your Amazon purchases through there, placetobenation.com/Amazon. A portion of the proceeds gets kicked back to the Place to Be boys to help them pay the bills and whatnot, as Chris Sellner used to say. And there are many different podcast feeds here, Pro Wrestling Only feed, Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed with the Place to Be podcast, and our Vantage Point, the brother band show of Greetings from Allentown. I suggest giving those a listen and a review on iTunes/Apple Music, and especially the Greatest Wrestler in WWE project that has been going on at Place to Be with the spectacular logo that is there. I just go to placetobenation.com just to look at the logo design of Vince McMahon, where he's wearing a Place to Be jacket. It's extremely well done. And give a listen to any number of the podcasts that have been released as part of this project. I know that when Pro Wrestling Only did the Greatest Wrestler Ever project about a year and a half ago was when that concluded, I learned so much from listening to the various viewpoints of everybody who weighed in on that. And for that reason, from just a WWF/WWE perspective, it'd be good to listen to the various voices that have weighed in on, say, an Adrian Adonis, a Seth Rollins, you know, really everybody through the whole history of the promotion. And right here, we're in 1986, and we are kicking off the year. It's the first Saturday of the year. Saturday Night's Main Event is the fourth Saturday Night's Main Event that was held. There was one the previous May in 85 that was sort of a de facto pilot, and it went so well that they brought it back in the fall for two more episodes before the end of 1985. And in early 1986, this would be the third episode of the season, as it were. So you might be wondering, what was the deal with SNL? Wasn't Saturday Night Live on during this time? Well, yes, it was, but anybody with any sort of vague familiarity with the history of Saturday Night Live, and for more of that, I definitely recommend the book Live from New York, which was released originally in 2002, but it has been updated many, many times since then, and it's not too expensive. You can even go through the PlaceToBeNation/Amazon and purchase a Kindle or softcover copy of the book for yourself. In 85, 86, that show was at such a nadir that it was beneficial for NBC to be running wrestling, which was still red hot, and WWF was separating themselves from other promotions in the United States, and Saturday Night Live was more or less in the toilet at the time, with a real hodgepodge of a cast that was thrown together without any real thought given to it at all. This was Lorne Michaels' return to Saturday Night Live after a 5-year hiatus. And as a matter of fact, the show was going to be canceled in 1985, but it was only brought back because Lorne Michaels agreed to return. And it was a very strange cast that he put together in 85, 86. Dennis Quaid, Robert Downey Jr., not Dennis Quaid, Randy Quaid. God, how the hell, why do I always get those guys confused? They're not even remotely like each other. Anthony Michael Hall. Who remembers Anthony Michael Hall literally as a Saturday Night Live cast member? There's just so many ill fits. Joan Cusack. So to have that preempted at that time period with wrestling on the rise and SNL on its way down made a lot of sense. But as you get a couple of years later and wrestling is starting to decline, let's say 1990, and SNL, led by Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey, Mike Myers, and the rest of that late 80s, early 90s cast that we all know and love, who have been fans of Saturday Night Live for years and years, there was less of a reason to preempt it for wrestling, even if it was just going to be a rerun of an earlier episode. I have to be careful when talking about Saturday Night Live, because I could go on and on and on about that show, because I am incredibly fascinated by the history of it, and it did help me win money in a contest at one time, which I'll quickly explain. In the public speaking contest in eighth grade, they said that you could do comedy instead of just reading poems or whatever people would do. I decided to do a improv skit for the first two rounds, which got me through. But for the third round and the final, on the stage in the auditorium, I decided I needed something that was more set in stone. So what I did was I took one of my SNL tapes of political sketches and memorized the 1992 presidential debate skit, which had, of course, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Ross Perot, and some other voices as well. So I was by myself up on the stage, and I was doing all the voices, one by one, the whole 9-minute skit. And I managed to win whatever the cash prize was for that, and I bought myself a pair of skis. Of course, I have not gone skiing since 1995. I purchased that in January of 1993. So a lot of good that did me in the long run. But suffice to say, I do enjoy SNL. Of course, it being preempted for wrestling was always a great thrill for me, because I didn't start really watching SNL until around 1991. So I would get the TV guide in the mail, as almost every American family had a subscription to TV Guide, it seems, in the late 1980s. And the first thing I would do is I would grab it and I would flip open to Saturday, 11:30 p.m. to see if it said Saturday Night Live or Saturday Night's Main Event. Because I never realized that there was an actual rhyme and reason to when Saturday Night's Main Event would be on. You would have the one around the start of the year here. You would have the one in early March that would lead up to WrestleMania. You would have another one post-WrestleMania about a month later, and then you'd have a break in the summer, and one in the fall, and then one a little bit later in the fall. Rinse, lather, repeat. And that generally was the way it went up through about 1990, when the bloom was coming off the rose with NBC. And I guess that was more 1991, when NBC did cut it off for good. On many Saturday Night Main Event episodes, there would be a prevailing theme. In one of the late 1985 episodes, it was centered around Halloween, and you had Roddy Piper getting pranked by some kids. You had another one that took place at the zoo, like Mutual of Omaha, something to do with that. That was around 1990 that I remember that taking place. And much like that, you had this one, which was Fun in the Sun, with many skits being filmed at a Tampa amusement park called Adventure Island. You get JYD versus Jimmy Hart on a water slide, and some other stuff that kind of gives this show a very, very different feel from your usual wrestling show. The looking back at these, as a fan, I would think to myself, if you're a wrestler, you would want to be on Saturday Night's Main Event, because more people, because it's a network show, more people are going to see you and you're going to have much more exposure. But what I had never really considered is the fact that it was very hard for them to sometimes find Hulk Hogan opponents because people were not willing to do the job in front of millions and millions of people on network television. In fact, that's how we ended up getting the truly bizarre Hulk Hogan versus Sika match from fall of 1987. That was supposed to be Hulk Hogan versus Kamala, but Kamala did not want to do the job on network television. And he was not alone in that. They all felt, oh, it would hurt my image or whatever. And here, of course, we have Terry Funk facing off against Hulk Hogan. And Funk does talk about that in his book, which I read from last week, and there are a few notes from his WWF tenure that I'll be reading from this week. It's Terry Funk, More Than Just Hardcore, by Terry Funk and Scott E. Williams. And here's what he has to say about this particular Saturday Night's Main Event. When we had our match in late 1985 on the fourth NBC Saturday Night's Main Event, we worked together fine, and I never had anything but a good relationship with Hogan when we were both in the WWF. I got the Saturday Night's Main Event assignment because nobody else wanted to do the job, and Vince wanted Hogan going over cleanly for the TV audience. A lot of guys felt like getting beaten in front of such a big audience would hurt their personas. There were no volunteers except for the Funker. They asked me to put him over on national TV, and I said, no problem at all. And that goes into Terry Funk's belief in himself that, yes, I can lose to Hulk Hogan in front of however many million people are watching this show, and it's not going to hurt me because I can just rebuild myself tomorrow because I am just that damn good, which Terry Funk is. And is certainly one of the five greatest wrestlers of all time. And I don't think I'll even entertain a debate on that. You can say Ric Flair is the greatest wrestler of all time, but Terry Funk, for everything that he's brought to the table over the years, his just incredible versatility, certainly belongs in the top five of any list. So when I get to the match with him and Hogan, he had kind of a weird relationship with Hulk Hogan predating all this WWF tenure, although, as it did mention in that last blurb, he did get along with Hogan just fine. This show, taking place in Hogan's actual hometown, not Venice Beach, California, but in Tampa at the Sun Dome, this was only the second WWF show in Tampa, which is very strange to think about, but yes, the Florida promotion was still around in 1986, nominally. Eddie Graham had committed suicide about a year before this, and the Florida promotion was really just kind of hanging on by a thread and would get swallowed up by Jim Crockett Promotions by the time 1987 rolled around. So this is only the second show that they've done there, the WWF making their presence felt in the state of Florida. And the Tampa Sun Dome would also become famous. This is a site where they would go back to for TV taping. So they really liked the building, which still stands, is a home for the University of South Florida, which I believe I mentioned in episode 4 because this is the same building where Andre turned on Hogan. That is where the Piper's Pit was at the Sundome in Tampa, Florida. Now, before I get into the show, I want to kind of make a distinction here. Obviously, all the Saturday Night Main Events are on the WWE Network, and you can certainly watch them there for $9.99 a month and all that jazz. However, I managed to see the copy on YouTube, which has the original music, and the original music really kind of gives it a different feel from seeing it on the network, where you have this bland sort of sound-alike music subbed in at various points. It's all commercial music, so it's kind of interesting to see. And of course, on this show, I do play little clips of songs that were popular at the time of when, you know, the show was made. So I'll be hearing whatever, like, one of the top hits was from the week of January 4th, 1986. So it was really fun to kind of watch the show as it originally aired. There are kind of some weird cuts, though, in the video. It comes in at 3 minutes shorter than the WWE Network version. And I haven't watched the network version to kind of do the comparison yet. At least in full, I've watched, I think, a third of it on the network today as I record this. So just have that in mind. And we might as well just jump right into the show. The show starts out with the song Walk of Life by Dire Straits playing, and I cannot listen to that song without thinking of the baseball bloopers from the video. Every time I hear the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, all I can picture is like Pete Rose diving to catch a pop-up that the catcher had dropped, or a guy falling into the dugout trying to make a catch, or somebody stumbling over third base. Something like that. It just sounds like baseball. It's now synonymous with baseball bloopers, and of course there's also football and stuff in there, but it's really just baseball. And if I've made anything clear through 29 episodes of this show, like, I'm really, really fat. I probably talk about baseball more than any wrestling podcaster out there right now, and honestly, I just can't help myself. So it's Gene Okerlund and Hulk Hogan, and they are making a shake together. And this is not a pineapple avocado smoothie or anything that hipsters like me, or alleged hipsters like me, would go down to the local whatever in order. This is... who knows what Hogan is putting in that shake? It is 85-86 Hogan here. So he's not egomaniacal out of his head. He's still kind of a normal human being. And he's getting Okerlund all pumped up here. And Gene doesn't know what's in the shake. And I thought to myself, hey, wasn't there a bit where Gene was training with Hulk Hogan for a Coliseum video that led up to a match in Minneapolis, or at least in the Minneapolis area? I believe it may have been at the Met Center. And yes, in 1984, there was a tag team match, as on a Coliseum video, Hulk Hogan and Gene Okerlund versus Mr. Fuji and George the Animal Steele. Because I'll never forget watching that as a kid. Like, why is Gene Okerlund wrestling? Like, I didn't quite understand why he would be put in that position. So, they mentioned the word gasoline, which, you know, I underline the word gas when it comes to Hogan in my notes here. And it's rather striking. They're out in the sun here, and Hogan is not wearing his usual bandana. So you know it is early Hogan, because he's not totally self-conscious about the top of his head. And I just hope that he sunblocked that thing, because you don't want to get a sunburn up there, Hogan. We don't want melanoma mania running wild, brother. So after we're done with them, we smash cut to a binocular view where Roddy Piper and the other baddies are taking a look at the hillbillies which would be Hillbilly Jim, Uncle Elmer, and Cousin Luke, who are just hanging out in inner tubes. Piper says that they're having their yearly bath. And I love that in this amusement park, he can just look across and see them in the giant wave pool or whatever. Jesse's getting a back rub by the women there, and Orton's just sort of hanging out before we get the opening theme song here. And Vince McMahon is doing the intro here by himself to start out. And this is a very Vince McMahon intro. It's not because he's overly excited or anything like that. It's just we get, you know, the usual Vince touchstones, the notwithstanding. But there are also a couple of rather striking things that Vince says.
Later on in the program, we'll have more fun in the sun. Right now, let's talk about wrestling.
Oh my God, he said the word wrestling. Vince McMahon said the word wrestling on a wrestling show. And not when he was saying World Wrestling Federation. He actually referred to the product as wrestling. Somehow that's so refreshing. Vince, in a slip of the tongue, actually says that the World Wrestling Federation is on the line in the Hulk Hogan-Terry Funk match.
Everyone waiting for the participants in the main event. The World Wrestling Federation up for grabs. The champion, Hulk Hogan, meeting the number one contender, Terry Funk.
Earlier, Vince had said that the Nikolai Volkoff versus Corporal Kirshner peace match was something out of the recent Geneva summit, which took place in November of 1985 and was the first meeting of President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, which, say whatever you will about President Ronald Reagan, and there's a lot of critiques that you could make about him, but in terms of foreign policy in his second term, the kind of détente and friendship that he developed with Mikhail Gorbachev was huge in ensuring that when the Soviet Union did collapse, that it did so peacefully, because it kind of allowed Gorbachev some room to implement some of his reforms, which, oddly enough, led to the end of the Soviet Union as we know it. Now, Ventura, Jesse Ventura, he crashes the set before Vince can get to introduce his match. He, of course, is in the six-man with Piper and Bob Orton against the three hillbillies from the inner tube. And Jesse is taking the approach here that this is historic, what he's doing here, as an announcer who is also going to be stepping into the ring. Although, when I think about it, Roddy Piper probably did the exact same thing in Georgia earlier in the 1980s, but let's not get bogged down on details like that. Jesse says you wouldn't see Brent Musburger stepping onto the field and playing linebacker or something to that effect. You wouldn't see Vin Scully stepping into the batter's box and taking a high, hard one from Dwight Gooden. I love the references to the big athlete of the time. Of course, Dwight Gooden's career was pretty much downhill after 85. Yes, he won the World Series in 86, but he was never as good as he was in 1985. Vince is very excited that he's going to lose Jesse on commentary for the first match, but Jesse interrupts and says, I'm not going to allow you to call this match by yourself because of your biased nature. So we get the first Saturday Night main event appearance of announcer Bobby Heenan, which is interesting in that when Jesse Ventura had left in the spring and summer of 1986, the WWF tried a team of Vince McMahon and Bobby Heenan, which was then nixed by NBC, who insisted that Jesse Ventura be part of the package. So he was then brought back and did most of the Saturday Night main events from then on. He's weirdly missing from the one in the fall of 1987, the one where the Honky Tonk Man hits Randy Savage over the head with the guitar. So we get to see Jesse Ventura in action here, and they throw it down to a promo with Rowdy Roddy Piper. And the Hot Rod asks an important question, which was effectively, how would you like having Uncle Elmer as your uncle. And I have to admit, it would probably be a source of great embarrassment, because I would like to think that in my own life, in my real life, my Uncle Phil, no, not Uncle Phil from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but my uncle who was actually named Phil, more accurately, his name is Phillips. I always thought that was weird that he was like plural. He was Phillips. I do think that despite the fact that I think he smoked until he was 50 and is a rather large man, although not over 300 pounds or anything like that, I do believe, I have no evidence of this, that my uncle was a better worker in ring than Uncle Elmer, despite never having seen him, you know, do anything athletic in his life. Although he did spend one family function talking for 45 minutes about the greatness of the 1960 Linfield High School football team, which I sat there and listened to, and I don't know how I felt about it, but it was certainly memorable enough that I remember it after all this time. So Piper brings up a good point there. And this match was built entirely within the confines of Saturday Night's Main Event, with it kind of like its own universe. On the second Saturday Night's Main Event, as I had mentioned in episode 17, you had the wedding of Uncle Elmer to that poor woman, and Jesse Ventura, who swears that it's some of the greatest work that he ever did, was instructed to bury Elmer on commentary, which he did.
Look at that, it looks like two carp in the Mississippi River going after the same piece of corn.
On the next Saturday Night's Main Event, Uncle Elmer was a guest in Piper's Pit, and they had surrounded Jesse Ventura, which was mentioned by Piper in the promo. So that set up the sixth man here, which is Cousin Luke, is one of the hillbillies this time. It used to be Cousin Junior, Lanny Keene, and he was replaced by Cousin Luke, for whatever reason, as the crappy hillbilly wrestler, which was effectively a gimmick of he doesn't know how to wrestle, which is one hell of a gimmick to give a guy who actually doesn't really know how to wrestle all that much. Although he was a actual worker named Jean Petit, who passed away in 2013. So we get a promo from the hillbillies, although only Jim actually talks here, and he says that they're going to approach this as professional athletes. And again, my mind just goes, and I'm wondering, what kind of a professional athlete would Cousin Luke even be? And I thought, he strikes me as a guy who, let's say you throw him in a baseball lineup, because I can't picture him as a basketball player. I sure as hell can't picture him as a hockey player, a soccer player, or a really anything else. I can think of him as a baseball player. And what Cousin Luke is a guy at the bottom of the batting order who, if there is a man on base, you want him to bunt the runner over, just like a pitcher batting. But he's not a pitcher. He's just a bad wrestler. He's not good at all. But he's a professional athlete, according to Jim. And yes, he is getting a payoff for this. So Heenan, when they hit the ring, says that they shouldn't be able to wrestle in those dirty Levi's. So I hope, for his own sake, that the brain is not watching Dean Ambrose these days, or else he might have a heart attack seeing him. Jesse starts out in this match, goes right to the eyes of Uncle Elmer, and then Elmer fights back, and we get some comical selling by Jesse Ventura. Really, really over the top stuff, and I was amused by it in the very least. Jesse, of course, nobody's going to accuse him of being a good worker, but he entertains me from time to time. Piper gets in and offers a handshake to Cousin Luke, who accepts and shakes his hand, but Luke kicks Piper in the gut. So maybe that number nine hitter did get a base hit off Roddy Piper, of all things. Piper gets back in control, and a really cool thing happens here where the heels cut off the ring beautifully, almost like they're kind of a weird Midnight Expressy type thing going on here. Although Piper and Ventura would go on to be tag team partners in the TV pilot tag team that came out in 1991 and was weirdly referenced by Jesse Ventura during WrestleMania 6 as Piper was coming to the ring and said, "I can't be objective during this match because Roddy is my tag team partner." And I never knew what that meant because I never knew about that show because it was a pilot that aired, I think, during Gulf War coverage. So there was a lot of distractions going on at that time. But yeah, a lot of fun stuff here with quick tags. You had Bob Orton getting in there, holding the leg, keeping Luke from getting over to his own corner. But eventually, Luke does get a tag. Referee doesn't see it, so we're building up that way. And eventually, though, very quickly after that, as a matter of fact, Uncle Elmer gets the tag. And you have Piper and Elmer in the ring slugging it out in very ugly fashion. Not even the great Roddy Piper could make that thing workable. Then you get a bear hug by Elmer in one of his more dynamic moves. And that is broken up by a thumb to the eye there. And everybody gets in the ring, and the hillbillies all clear the ring, which is generally the sign for the NBC commercial break. And Hillbilly, when we get back, he gets in there and has some shine against Roddy Piper, but Piper then slaps him a couple of times. Then we get a tag to Cousin Luke, and I just write here, Cousin Luke House of Fire? He's a number nine hitter. He should just sacrifice bunt. Piper avoids a body slam, kind of jumps up and around to avoid a slam and slaps on a sleeper. And now everybody is back in the ring again. And Luke actually breaks up the sleeper, but then decides to run the ropes. And Cowboy Orton hits him with the cast outside the ring. He's still wearing that cast that the arm injury he suffered at MSG early in 1985. That cast thing was not as long as I had thought it was in my own memory. I had always thought that he had worn it almost from the moment he came in at the beginnings of 1984, but no, he did not start wearing it until just before WrestleMania, which makes sense because they made the big deal of it when it came to the finish of the WrestleMania main event. Everybody gets in. As I said, Luke breaks up the sleeper. Orton hits him. Then Piper locks on the sleeper again, and we get a very quick referee checking the arm in very rapid fashion. And they did the best they could here with this match. They kept Elmer out of the ring, thank God. It was mostly Cousin Luke doing basic stuff. Jim wasn't in there all that much, but it was some great work by the heel team there of Ventura, Piper, and Orton. And this is more or less the last you would see of Jesse Ventura in a wrestling ring working. He may have done a few tag matches after this on house shows, but you certainly do not see him on any Saturday Night's main event. He hosts the Body Shop until around WrestleMania 2. A few of the All-Star Wrestling episodes had been taped before WrestleMania 2, up to about the end of April. And then the body disappears for much of 1986, much like Roddy Piper does. So Bob Orton, out of that three-man trio there, he's kind of left by himself with nothing to do, so he takes up residence in the flower shop as the bodyguard to Adrian Adonis in the late summer, which leads right in to the Piper-Adonis feud, which I covered in Episode 1. And yes, do check out my archives on SoundCloud before I joined the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I had 15 episodes there, and including the aforementioned Andre Hogan Piper's Pit. The sky has shown up, light turning stone to bread, and so we all must lend a helping hand. We are the world, we are the children, we are the one to make a brighter day. So yeah, I have to point out the Bruce Springsteen portion in We Are the World by USA for Africa. Quite a super group. Bruce Springsteen's appearance in that video is very strange because he just kind of pops in as like the eighth or ninth musician and it looks like he just emerged from a shower with a low-flow shower head. He looks like in that Seinfeld episode where they installed all the different shower heads in the building and Jerry shows up and his hair is all flat. That's Bruce in that video. And it was quite a super group that they put together with Lionel Richie in the leadoff spot. But there were certain criticisms of it, despite all the great artists, in that it was a rather self-indulgent song, which may be the case, but it's so neat to see all those guys together. Except, of course, for Michael Jackson, who was a part of the song, but he actually recorded his bit away from everybody else. So when you watch the video, Michael Jackson is just standing like almost like in a room by himself, and then it cuts back to Willie Nelson and many others doing the song at the same time. On the substituted commercial music front, we have Take On Me by A-ha playing on the original broadcast as they go back to Adventure Island in Tampa, Florida. That is the amusement park where this is all taking place. And this is actually very close to Busch Gardens in Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay. And this water park, Adventure Island, opened in June of 1980. It is part of SeaWorld Entertainment. And I don't know what this slide is that the Junkyard Dog will be racing Jimmy Hart on. It may be one of the slides that closed years ago. They shut down two of the slides and reworked them as different things. Of course, you have different, like, 10 water slides and, like, 4 or 5 wave pools. So, you know, standard fare for any water park that you would ever see. So JYD had gotten to Jimmy Hart at a recent show and had branded Hart, who was in his underwear, with Terry Funk's iron. And Jimmy Hart wants revenge. So he says, I can't wrestle the Junkyard Dog, so I'm going to challenge him to a water slide race. And this is the kind of, you know, whatever silliness that you would get on Saturday night's main event. And they each get to give a little speech, and it's ready, set, go. And noticeably, Jimmy Hart starts about a second and a half or 2 seconds too late. And JYD easily wins the water slide race. And it just makes me think, the WWF is such a babyface promotion at that point in time that heels can't even go over in a water slide race that means nothing. Although I don't know how Jimmy Hart could necessarily cheat in a water slide race other than maybe doctoring the other slide that JYD is on. Jesse, who is at the bottom of the pool, comments that JYD is used to being on his back, so that's why he won, and that Jimmy Hart was wearing some sort of friction-based shoes. I don't understand what he's saying, but Jesse is at the bottom, and he is with Terry Funk, the star of our program here. And Jesse rightfully points out, hey, Terry, you don't seem like a water park or amusement park kind of guy. What are you doing here? And Terry points out that Hogan was on the cover of SI, and he wants to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated as well. And Hulk Hogan was on the cover of Sports Illustrated in April of 1985, where they did an article on professional wrestling. I don't know if that's available in the SI vault. That's changed over the years, where I don't think their content online is as freely available as it once was. And Terry's wearing all of his cowboy gear, hanging out by the wave pool.
You don't really look like the beach type to me. What are you doing here?
Tonight, after I beat the heavyweight champion Hulk Hogan, all the national press will be taking my picture, and I want a great tan for the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Well, I don't know if Sports Illustrated's here, Terry.
They better be. They put that overrated blonde blowhard Hogan on the cover. They better put me on it when I'm through, or I'll fry them, both of them. I'll fry them with my iron. That's a promise. Do you understand, Ventura?
Yes. Well, Sports Illustrated, you've been warned.
That promo is good, but it lacks the certain zestiness that we got last week when Terry Funk is mixing it up with Lance Russell. So I'm just saying, Terry Funk, still good in pretty much every setting, but when you have a Lance Russell there to play off of, it is all the better. They do a flashback to a show in Denver with Gorilla Monsoon, of all people, making a very rare Saturday Night's Main Event appearance. I don't recall Gorilla's voice or appearing on very many Saturday Night Main Event. This is from November 15th at the McNichols Arena in Denver, Colorado, where Funk hit Hogan with a branding iron. He eventually won by countout and branded Hogan after the match. And Funk, of course, did that thing where he grabbed the belt thinking that he had won the belt via countout, which always bugged me as a kid, that wrestlers were dumb enough to believe that they didn't even know the freaking rules, where they would always hold up the belt. And this continued for years and years, long after it was well established. But anyway, that might be just me. Who knows? So Terry holds up the belt, but unfortunately, we don't get a clear shot of it. And that's one of my favorite things to collect on my phone. I'm a real weirdo. I like pictures of guys holding up belts that they never actually won or never actually, you know, had at any time in their career. Example, I have a screenshot, similar thing, Randy Savage wearing the Hulk Hogan 1985 championship belt. Obviously, he would become a WWF champion down the road, but he would never win that particular belt. Another one that I have, Andre holding up the Intercontinental title. At some point, I don't recall when that would have been, probably 1989 with Ultimate Warrior or something like that. And of course, Mr. Perfect holding up a tag team title after winning the Intercontinental Championship in 1990 in that tournament, because they didn't have an IC belt apparently in the building at the time. And they had all those weird IC titles with the different color straps for the Warrior, and they had to renormalize it for a guy like Curt Hennig. So Hulk Hogan's promo here, he's looking to prevent what happened in Denver, Colorado, so he's brought in somebody to keep an eye on Jimmy Hart. So he will have the Junkyard Dog in the corner, who, a very busy man. He's on water slides, he's appearing in the corner of Hogan, and he's actually in a match later on this show. So JYD, lazy as all hell, but you can't accuse him of not working hard in this one. And given what we know about Hulk Hogan and his restaurant policy in Tampa, Florida, I guess he considers Junkyard Dog the, quote, the right kind of black, as it were, in Hogan's very, very unenlightened views on race. Terry Funk and Hulk Hogan, they knew each other very well. And there were a couple of instances in his book that I would like to bring up. First, I'm going to bring up the one that was a little bit later, after they had met for the first time. Funk talks about Hulk Hogan and the Rocky III connection. Goes, I actually was the one who connected Hulk Hogan with Sylvester Stallone for the part of Thunderlips in Rocky III. Stallone called me up and said he needed a huge wrestler for the part of, well, a huge wrestler. I gave him a few names, and it came down to Sly choosing between Hulk Hogan and Gorilla Monsoon, whom Vince McMahon Sr. suggested. Can you imagine Gorilla Monsoon as Thunderlips? I mean, God, what a change that is. I mean, it'd be a completely different movie. It would be more of like a comic character, like haha comedy character, than the kind of huge, you know, Thunderlips, you know, pressing Rocky and all that sort of stuff. And yes, Hogan and Terry Funk had a history dating back to the very early 1980s. And this is from Terry Funk's book. I had worked with Hogan before. In 1981, we worked in Sun City, South Africa. No, that's fine, because there was no cultural boycott led by Steve Van Zandt at that time, so it was okay for them to play Sun City. And the adage was true. Don't go to Sun City, especially if you're wrestling on a show run by a bunch of packies. I'm not entirely sure what he means there, but I'm just quoting what he said. I'd set the whole thing up for Hogan, $35,000 cash, which was certainly more than the $8,000 I was getting. Good thing I had a big run on a blackjack table. I set him up with a better deal than I did for myself, but I went directly to Hogan with it and around Vern Gagne, and I was happy about that because I wanted him to make the money from it and not have to share it with Gagne. We had a really great match, and then Terry asked me, would you pick up my money? Probably the only time Hogan has ever said a sentence without ending it with brother. He said he was due to wrestle in Japan, so I told him getting him his money would be no problem. But when I did, I had to do all the money changing. I had to ride with the Packies, and they took the worst roads I've ever seen. There I was, riding in a Mercedes, with one idiot to the right of me, one to the left, and three in the front seat. That sounds like a Steelers Wheel song. Sun City was technically in South Africa, but everything in the city was done in Botswana money, including our wrestling payoffs. We had to change our Botswana money into South African rands. To do that, we had to go into this remote outpost in the damn jungle where there were baboons, lions, and every other goddamn animal you can think of. The Packies were not happy. They only drew a crowd of about 300 for the show, and they laid out all this money, so I was telling them what great guys they were and laughing at their shitty jokes. After getting my money in rands, I had to take it to the South African bank and have it transferred to my bank in the States, my money in Hulk's, because I couldn't change it into dollars there. They said the transfer would take 10 days to 2 weeks. About 2 days after I got home, I got a call from Hogan's mama. "Where's Terry's money?" "Well, ma'am," I said, "it's going to be here. It's going to be a little while." It finally came through, though, and I sent it to him. So, yes, Terry Funk in Africa and the trials and tribulations of trying to convert money. Of course, Sun City is very, very complicated place during the time of apartheid. And the boycott wouldn't happen until later in the 1980s. Of course, this was in 1981. Terry also points out that he had a trip to Nigeria and said that there was some promoter there called Power Mike who was, quote, the true asshole of the world, the most rotten son of a bitch in the world. And I love Terry's book because he holds nothing back. I put it on a level with Bret Hart's book, although I don't think I'm going to end up doing a 17-part series on my blog like I did for Bret Hart's book last summer, where I broke down so many damn passages, probably over 100 passages in Bret Hart's book. So here we are, Hulk Hogan versus Terry Funk for the WWF Championship. And Hogan, in a real rarity for the time, wearing the blue trunks with the red shirt that says Hulkamania in yellow lettering on there. So yeah, kind of a different look for Hogan, kind of wearing the alternate jersey here. The blue is not something you would see on any kind of stage for Hogan. We're so used to the yellow trunks with the red knee pads. And in fact, the last time you would see Hogan in anything other than the yellow trunks and red knee pads during this WWF run in the 80s and into the early 90s was in June of 1987, June 14th, 1987, at Madison Square Garden for a Texas Death Match against Harley Race, which is on Daily Motion. Although, to be fair, it was only the second most famous thing that happened in New York on that day, because it is also the day of the fictional Keith Hernandez error that led to a 5-run Phillies night that caused Kramer and Newman to get spit on by, not Hernandez, but Roger McDowell, the current Baltimore Orioles pitching coach. I should also point out that Hogan's music here is Real American. So they've moved him onto that music. It's on the original broadcast, and of course it is on the network where Real American is dubbed in for Hogan shows before the song was ever even created, which is always kind of a mind screw, particularly with the Chris Jericho Break the Walls Down for dubbed in for the WCW shows. So yes, we only got Hulk Hogan's theme for a very short period as I went over in episode 17. That was November of 1985, and here we are in December, and live in the arena, they are playing a different theme for Hulk Hogan. So very short-lived was that one from the wrestling album. Get a quick start with a lot of reversals on a whip going into the corner, and Hogan does the, what I have to call the Hogan clothesline to the corner. It's kind of a staple of Hogan matches where he would whip a guy in and Hogan would rush in after him and hit him with a clothesline almost at the exact same moment that the guy hit the corner turnbuckle. It's not something that I've seen anybody else ever do. I think somebody should steal that spot because it's been 20 or 30 years and it would remind people like me, hey, that's one of the Hulk Hogan spots that he would do. And Terry bumps to the outside, falls out of the ring after Hogan clothesline. Now, Jesse on commentary here is this is amazing because Terry Funk at this point in time is in his early to mid 40s, and you get to ECW in 1997, and we know what his gimmick was called, but it's very interesting to hear Jesse Ventura calling him the exact same thing here.
He likes to refer to himself as middle-aged and crazy.
I don't think anybody had quite a run of being quote-unquote middle-aged like Terry Funk, literally over a decade, with that kind of being the thing that he was. Certainly went a hell of a lot better for him than it went for Dominic DiNucci, as Kelly pointed out on the Titans of Wrestling show, where there was that period where Dom DiNucci, he was teaming up with random jobbers later in his career, and you know, he would not be the guy who would take the pin, but it was just a very strange thing. Funk, he's really working hard for Hogan here. Hogan is running the ropes, and Funk drops down, and Hogan just keeps running the ropes, but he's stepping on Terry each time to kind of make his point. Three times, as a matter of fact. And Funk ends up outside the ring, and he throws a chair into the ring. So a Terry Funk staple. And these are not folding chairs either. These are the ones that are just upright, and you can't fold them or anything, but they're kind of plastic in nature there. So that's a lot of fun. We get a back suplex by Hogan. So he's working those All Japan spots with Funk, who's, of course, a very familiar face with Giant Baba. Hogan being much more of a New Japan guy, although the relationship between the WWF and New Japan had come to a close in the middle of 1985, and Hogan really wasn't going there anymore. At least after the first WrestleMania, Hogan had stopped making appearances there. We get the transition with a low blow mule kick by Terry to take over. Terry Funk. I should be clear. It's the battle of the two Terrys here. You know, the two most famous Terrys in the history of professional wrestling. Sorry, Terry Taylor. You're not going to make the cut here. Besides, his real name isn't even Terry. Funk actually does get crotched on the ropes when Hogan shakes the ropes as Hogan goes up, as Terry Funk goes up to the top rope, and we get an atomic drop and a fun reaction from Vince.
What Terry Funk knee to the spine? Oh, baby!
That's a new one. Although, I think I prefer, in general, the Vince McMahon laugh. Even if it's just hillbillies dancing in the ring, it's just something that I've become accustomed to over the years. Now, anyway, this is kind of weird how Hogan is so dominant in this match, but we get our second attempt at a transition where Jimmy Hart grabs the leg of his future charge, Hulk Hogan, and Hart is chased by the Junkyard Dog under the ring, and in a mild business-exposing moment, they happen to have a camera underneath the ring that catches Jimmy Hart trying to get under there. Now, why in the production meeting, if you're looking at it from kayfabe, why would NBC have a functioning camera under the ring? Why is that? As all this is going on, Terry Funk takes some wrist tape and starts choking Hulk Hogan with it. And Jesse Ventura, in commenting on it, speaks for us all.
What a ring genius Terry Funk is.
No disagreement coming from me. Pile driver by Funk. Not quite as good as the Paul Orndorff one. It didn't look like you got all of it, Jess. And he goes for the pin and a very noticeable slow count by referee Dave Hebner. And Jesse complains about it loudly and vociferously on commentary. And I did a three count myself here to kind of at like a normal pace. And it should have been a three count. And Terry Funk should have been the World Wrestling Federation champion going into WrestleMania 2, defending in a steel cage against Hulk Hogan. I have no issue with the way they did the Bundy angle, because that was a great angle they did at the next Saturday night's main event. But Terry Funk defending the WWF title against Hulk Hogan in a steel cage would have been a pretty neat memory for all of us. Hulk does the lazy kick out where he kind of rolls the shoulder over to one side, which I talked about a couple of episodes ago. And shortly thereafter, we have a Hulk up. But remember, the Hulk up in 1986 at this time is very different from the formula Hulk up 1988 and after. It doesn't go exactly the same. There's a lot more variations and permutations in the way it would go. And Terry is just throwing those right hands. It's kind of surprising. I don't know why he's not throwing the left hands that Terry Funk is famous for. But, yep, we got the Hulk Hogan back elbow, big boot. But Funk falls to the outside. And Hogan gets Funk up on the apron and goes to suplex him back in. Referee gets distracted for one reason or another. And Jimmy Hart hits Hulk Hogan with the branding iron again. Funk goes for the pin. 1-2, Hogan foot on the ropes, which Funk does not see. And he gets into a dispute with Dave Hebner about that because he did not see the foot on the ropes and believes that he should now be the champion. Junkyard Dog hits Jimmy Hart on the outside to get back at him for the branding iron incident. I guess JYD a little late there in preventing the earlier shenanigans. We get a big clothesline to the distracted Terry Funk by Hogan. For some reason, I had remembered it as being the Axe Bomber that he finished him off here, but it was really just a big lariat. Not entirely sure why Hogan was so reluctant to use the Axe Bomber in the United States, at least outside of the context of the movie No Holds Barred, where he was using the Axe Bomber as a finisher, as Rip Thomas. It was literally how he killed Zeus at the end of the movie. He killed him using the Axe Bomber. And he picks up the 1-2-3, and Funk has a very interesting way of getting his heat back after the match. He kind of assaults Hebner, throws him to the outside, and then throws a chair into the ring again. Not once, not twice, but thrice. So three of those chairs make their way into the ring. It's not quite the opening from ECW where you see 50,000 chairs getting thrown on to the public enemy as Terry Funk is trying to get the hell out of there. This is a very fun match between Hogan and Terry Funk. If you put yourself in the time period, it's plausible that Terry Funk, not a big muscle man, not one of the big fat monsters that Hogan would face later, but it's very plausible that he could win the WWF title and set up a chase for Hogan to perhaps get it back at WrestleMania 2. No problems with how they ended up booking these things in the end. I'm just a Terry Funk fan who would have loved to have seen him have a 2 or 3 month run with the belt. Of course, Funk would leave the WWF shortly after WrestleMania 2. I think he only had one Saturday Night's Main Event match after that at the May Saturday Night's Main Event, and then he was gone shortly thereafter. His brother would be coming into the promotion in a February episode of Championship Wrestling, interfering in a match against the Junkyard Dog, which is a very interesting video to watch because he's called Dory and he's not being called Haas yet by Vince McMahon. Of course, Vince loathed to call him Dory Funk Jr. because we can't call anybody Jr. because that is one of Vince McMahon's big bugaboos. So, great match here, but it's not quite over yet as you get an in-ring promo by Hogan after the match as JYD is in also. And he says, why don't you drag off that manager of yours? And literally, Terry Funk drags the the beaten Jimmy Hart off by his pant leg and drags him across the cement floor to the back. It's quite a fun visual. I'll probably try to make a GIF file of that, although I think it actually gets cut out of the YouTube of it here. Hogan says, I ain't had enough of you, Terry Funk, and asks for him to come back, but he does not. And JYD, he has very little to say because he's working harder than he'll ever work again, I guess. And he says, they don't call me Deputy Dog for nothing. So, okay, that was a nice written line or whatever come up on the spot by JYD. So, very fun match, Hulk Hogan and Terry Funk, one of my personal favorite Saturday Night Main Event matches.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Had one of those moments where I wasn't sure I heard what I thought I heard during this next kind of introductory segment, almost a vignette for George the Animal Steel, where they show his comings and goings in 1985, his appearance on the first Saturday Night's Main Event, and actually the first match on that show, him running back into the woods or whatever, into the bushes at the Detroit Zoo. Detroit, of course, being the actual hometown of Jim Myers, a.k.a. George Steele. And then the famous electroshock therapy from Dr. Sigmund Ziff. And this is where I thought I had heard something. He was referred to as a gynecologist / psychologist by Vince. And I thought that Vince had lost his mind there, but apparently this was one of those Lou Albano-isms where I always get this screwed up, whether it's a malapropism or a spoonerism, and I probably should look that up right now, but it's one of those things where you just get the definition of the thing wrong. And clearly he's not a gynecologist, he's a psychologist, and the George Steele thing went a little crazy on that episode of Tuesday Night Titans, and George kind of lost his way there. He goes down the water slide, and Okerlund wonders if, on his return to the ring after oh so many months, whether he'll have ring rust. And Albano has a good line. He says, will he have ring rust? What, because of the water? Good job by Captain Lou there. And Steele is a kind of important figure, at least within the Saturday Night's Main Event universe, through the first 2.5 to 3 years of the show. As I mentioned, the first match of the first show is the babyface turn for George Steele, which was him in a six-man team with the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov, who, once they tagged him in, they refused to have anything to do with him, and they abandoned him in the ring, and it took Captain Lou coming out to sort of calm him down. And then, of course, you have his series with the Macho Man Randy Savage, which begins on this show next, which would continue January 87 for the Intercontinental title. Of course, Savage would win the title a month after this show aired. Then another match in March of 87 before WrestleMania 3. This one was for the services of the lovely Elizabeth as manager, which Steele lost via countout. And then May of 1987, the final match, a lumberjack match on Saturday Night's Main Event between the two. And that was mercifully it for that feud, for Randy Savage's sake anyway. And then a final match for Steele in November of 1987 in the all-important opening match. Like I said, the opening match on Saturday Night's Main Event is very critical to drawing in the casual fans' eye and keeping them tuned in, because as I said, at 11:30 at night, anything that, you know, becomes boring or lacks entertainment value, people will switch off their TVs and go to bed, or they will just, you know, keep on drinking and flip to another channel or something like that. And while he may not speak to somebody who is enough into wrestling to podcast about it 2 hours a week, or to watch wrestling from all over the world, from Japan and Europe and whatnot, George Steele wasn't for the hardcore wrestling fan. He was to draw those casual eyes. And that's something over time that I've come to accept, is the silliness of George Steele is there to bring more people into the tent, bring more money into the company. And he was effective at what he did for this little 3-year run from 85 to 87. Granted, it was not pretty in the ring, but he did everything Vince asked of him. Now, Randy Savage, they cut to him with Jesse, and they are on a bridge with Elizabeth over kind of a waterfall pool area. And this trio was actually a bit of a kind of tag team unit for a while. Savage and Ventura tagged for a very brief period before Ventura's career fully came to an end. And they're asking, are you going to teach Elizabeth how to swim? And Macho Man just throws her off the bridge to kind of give her that hard lesson. And yes, it's just Elizabeth being thrown into a pool of water, which now we know from the Vince McMahon appearance on the Stone Cold podcast in 2014 that is how Vince gets his jollies. People being thrown into bodies of water literally gets Vince McMahon hard, for lack of a better term. So that's why just the weirdness of that segment, kind of insinuating that Elizabeth doesn't know how to swim and she's being thrown into a body of water. It wasn't too high. It was probably a height of about 10 feet, but it was probably deep enough in the pool there for all that. So Vince admonishes Jesse for laughing at all this as the Macho Man makes his way to the ring. And Steele is already in the ring. Macho Man gets distracted by somebody at ringside, so he decides to start chatting. And it's not a stunt granny or anything like that. It's just some random dudes. And what that sets up is Liz inexplicably decides to continue holding open the ropes, even though Savage is nowhere near the apron. And Steele comes over and starts pawing at her shoulder, which the innocence of George Steele kind of overrides the creepiness of the entire thing. And that kind of is why you're able to accept this angle going on, where there was a lot of leering, because George Steele isn't necessarily looked at as a lecherous guy. He's looked at as a complete simpleton. That's why he's the animal. And boy, it's amazing how things changed in a 2-month span from that November of 85 episode of Championship Wrestling that I reviewed in episode 17, where Elizabeth is mouthing off to Hulk Hogan in the ring, saying that he doesn't face suitable competition. And only 8 weeks after that, Liz is in that familiar, submissive role where she's being kind of almost abused, really, either if not physically, then certainly emotionally. Now, one thing about this match that definitely stands out is our referee here, who you may... The referee is Dean Malenko, future WWF Cruiserweight Champion, future WCW United States Champion, WCW Cruiserweight Champion, man of 1,000 holds, working as the referee for the start of this never-ending feud, which I just discussed the Saturday Night main event portion of this feud, but let's not forget the WrestleMania 2 match that these guys had, which was really bizarre when you watch it. A lot of people don't like to go back and watch WrestleMania 2. I tend to think it's a little bit better, at least in the last two cities. Once you get past that awful moolah mess with Velvet McIntyre that I think led off in Chicago, it gets pretty good towards the end in Chicago, and I like the LA section quite a bit because you have the Steamboat match, the Cage match, and the Funk Brothers tag match. But you also had George Steele versus Savage, and that was in the early portion of the show in Nassau Coliseum. A truly strange match that was about 5 or 6 minutes, because everything felt rushed at the beginning to make sure that they would have enough time on the back end. The thing I want to point out from that match is George Steele kicked out of the top rope elbow of Randy Savage in that match. I cannot stress that enough, how weird that is that that happened. When it's Hulk Hogan in WrestleMania 5, you come to accept it. And the reason why is because we know Hulk Hogan has that superpower where when Savage drops the big elbow on him, it wakes him up and all that kind of stuff. We learn that years later. But George Steele kicking out of it and then getting protected in the pinfall loss with the feet on the rope deal, the one of the many Ric Flair finishes, just truly bizarre. And then, of course, Steele in the corner, who helped Steamboat beat Randy Savage in WrestleMania 3 by shoving the Macho Man off the top rope when he had the ring bell there. So, a lot of history between these two guys, and this is the very beginning of that. Now, for all the talk of how this feud would have driven Savage nuts because of the whole Liz obsession and Steele's unorthodox wrestling style, maybe not suiting what Savage could do as a whole, he was actually perfectly suited, I think, to work with Steele, because in this match you get a lot of this weird Memphis-style shtick and stalling to start, where Savage is kind of fleeing the ring because you have Steele doing that thing with his arms over his head like he's casting a spell on the Macho Man. And Savage eventually gets thrown out over the top rope, and kudos to Elizabeth, who gets out of the way this time, unlike at the main event 2, as covered a couple of episodes ago. We get a chase outside the ring, and Savage hides behind Elizabeth. Steele is always distracted by the lovely Elizabeth every time he goes by. There is not a lot in terms of interesting moves to call in this match, because it's a George Steele match in 1986, and he's over 50 years old at this point, and there's no way in hell he's going to be able to keep up with Randy Savage. But he takes a bite out of a turnbuckle, and as I said, not very much to go on here, but the double axe handle from across the ring on the distracted Steele finishes for the Macho Man. Though I must point out, and this was probably unintentionally a way of protecting Steele in defeat, he had his arm underneath the bottom rope during the pinfall. So bad job by Dean Malenko to not stop the count, seeing that he had his arm underneath the ropes, which I believe would be the equivalent of a guy having a foot on the rope. And Savage is so freaked out by this whole experience of facing George Steele that instead of just rushing to the back with Elizabeth, he picks her up on his shoulder like he's carrying a 50-pound bag of dog food and has decided to just hurry to the back to get the hell out of there and say, boy, I hope I never have to face this guy again. Well, you'd be wrong, because including house shows and all that sort of stuff, you're going to be facing him dozens and dozens more times.
Wait, what did he just say? I thought I heard him say something. He belched, I think. That wasn't a belch.
Go back to Hogan in Oakland, and they're in the same spot as they were when they opened the program. And Oakland is listening to some music and getting down. Of course, this is a huge contrast between the video on YouTube and what you'll see on the network in terms of the music. And Hogan and Okerlund have some interaction introducing this video that reminds me of somebody driving a stick shift who'd never driven a stick shift before. It's going about as poorly as Ed Lewis in Pretty Woman when he's driving the stick shift very badly and goes up and pulls up and meets Julia Roberts for the first time. I actually just saw that movie for the first time last week, a 27-year-old movie that won Oscars and stuff. So, yeah, I'm cramming in the reference right here. So the song on the network is this weird thing that I looked up, and apparently it's just kind of an in-house crafted whatever. There's a riot in the streets, and I'm not going to settle for any bull crap like that. I'm going for original sauce here, which is Billy Ocean's "When the Going Gets Tough, the Tough Get Going."
When the going gets tough, the tough get going, 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 tough.
One thing about having this song is that it syncs to the action a lot better than the network overdub. And I'm always very interested in these videos, for it shows who the WWF truly values and they're going to put into this year in review thing. And the first thing that I notice is that there's an awful lot of footage from the Saturday Night's Main Event from the prior year that's being used here. Piper and Mr. T, so you're going to work in a lot of WrestleMania. There's Pat Patterson looking quite rotund there in his role as referee in 1985. Piper with the chair on Hogan outside the ring. Mr. T, and he'll be making his return very soon to the WWF for WrestleMania 2. Oh, there's Hillbilly Jim getting squashed there. Andre throwing the money out in an iconic moment. Heenan hitting Lou Albano with the trophy in the 1985 Manager of the Year. Ooh, there was Vince doing the Land of a Thousand Dances. It is one of the early Randy Savage-Tito Santana matches. I know you're probably not watching this as I'm narrating it, but is Piper almost groping Elizabeth in the ass during the Pass the Apple thing where you're not supposed to use your hands in the Halloween episode. Paul Orndorff going crazy. Now there's Barry Windham. Here's the first appearance by somebody who is no longer in the promotion, which is very interesting. There was briefly Jimmy Snuka. Hogan playing guitar. He looks right at home. Hillbillies. They really, really value the Hillbillies. For some reason, we get Fabulous Moolah in there, Cyndi Lauper, and Wendi Richter, who they had literally screwed out of the title in November of 1985, but yet she appears in this video. I don't know how far in advance this was pre-produced, but she was gone November 25th, 85. This is 6 weeks later. Albano getting smacked over the head with the record, cementing his face turn, although that was actually in 1984, in December, at Madison Square Garden. And footage of the Piper versus Orndorff match from Saturday Night's Main Event. And they had some crazy brawls around the horn that would ordinarily end in double countout. I feel like there could have been something even more extended between those two. Even drag it out to WrestleMania 2 instead of doing the stupid Mr. T boxing match. Junkyard Dog with his mother dancing in the ring from the first Saturday Night's Main Event. A lot of hillbillies in here. I mean, they were somewhat over, and they were certainly valued, but oh my God, were the other two, Hillbilly Jim, nice guy, but nothing to really watch in the ring. And you get the iconic Hogan pose there at the end. So we move on to the next match here. And, well, not before Jesse gripes about the fact that he was not included in the video, to which I would point out to Jesse that you were not really in the ring for really any time in 1985. You had the blood clots in late 84 that derailed the program with Hulk Hogan, and then your return mostly happened in early 1986, and he was no longer in the ring after the WrestleMania 2 period, because he went away, made Predator, and then came back in the fall. We get a Nikolai Volkoff promo where he says that Russians are peaceful, to which I just roll my eyes and say, yeah, I've lived through 2016 and 2017. Whatever you say, Nikolai. The Iron Sheik is there as well for moral support as tag team partner of Nikolai Volkoff. Now, the Sheik, always famous for his line, Russia number one, Iran number one, which makes me wonder. And if I ever met the Iron Sheik, I would ask him this, and he would probably think that I was the one on drugs. Why does he always say Russia number one first? Shouldn't he put his own country ahead of Russia? It's already ahead of it alphabetically, unless, you know, there's some sort of weird, like, extra part of the people's, some kind of, like, how Libya's full, the Libyan full name of the country was the Great Socialist People's Libyan Arab Jamharia, back when Gaddafi. I don't know if there's a weird name. I know it's the Islamic Republic of Iran, I think is what it is. And Russia, who knows? We go to Jesse, who is by one of the wave pools, or actually it looks like kind of a regular pool, with Corporal Kirshner, who, much like Colonel Gaddafi, you would think he would have rose to a higher rank, especially since Kirshner could have just given himself, it's friggin' pro wrestling, you can give yourself any rank, he could be a 5-star general, but instead he's just going with the name Corporal. And Jesse is noticeably not on Kirshner's case here. He's not all over him like he was Sergeant Craig Pittman in his background in the Marines in that Worldwide episode I did a few weeks ago. And Kirshner is going to, he's from the 82nd Airborne, so he's going to show us how to zip line into the water for whatever reason. Probably because we're in a water park. And Jesse and Corporal Kirshner had something of a rapport. Like I said, the complete opposite as the Sergeant Craig Pittman deal from WCW in 1994. As a matter of fact, there, apparently there is an edition of The Body Shop, Jesse Ventura's talk show, from the March 29th, 1986 episode of All Star Wrestling that I wish was on YouTube, or I wish at least the Body Shop segment was on YouTube. It's nowhere to be found, where Jesse apparently kind of broke character in kind of agreeing and siding with Corporal Kirshner with their shared military service, which would be kind of a neat thing to be able to see. Cut back to the ring, and Nikolai Volkoff has the Soviet National Anthem going, and we only get one verse before Kirshner's music interrupts with the whole parade march to the ring. Ventura says that he interrupted, but really the anthem was over, and Volkoff was not going to do multiple verses at this point in the evening on NBC. So this is, as mentioned, a peace match, which is a nobody breaks the rules, kind of a no tolerance for any sort of rule breaking. So I think you can tell where this is going to go here. We have Dean Malenko again as the referee, so hopefully he does a better job here than he did in the Savage Steel match where he screwed up and didn't notice that Steel's arm was under the rope. Corporal Kirshner has been kind of a interesting figure discussed on the Place to Be podcast as it marched through 1986. Let's just say that Corporal Kirshner loved getting high, is apparently the situation with him. He loved the ganja. He loved, if he had had a diva as his manager, her name definitely would have been Mary Jane. Greg Valentine needs 15 minutes to get warmed up for a match, famously. But Corporal Kirshner only needs 420 in order to get warmed up for his matches. So we have the peace match here. And to be fair to Kirshner, I just made a string of jokes about him. He did go on to some mild success as Leatherface in Japan, something of a kind of a horror movie character. He was also supposed to be in the WrestleMania 17 Battle Royal, gimmick Battle Royal, once again, but he didn't make the appearance for whatever reason. I guess he just smoked too much weed and just Blum forgot about it. Who knows? This match is so weird on a lot of different levels. Not just because they shake hands at the beginning of it, like it's Ring of Honor circa 2002 or something like that. The psychology of it is so weird because of the whole peace match aspect to it, where it really feels like we're just sitting around and waiting for Nikolai Volkoff to cheat to win the match, or for Kirshner to somehow overcome that cheating and win the match himself, either by Volkoff getting disqualified or by him just overcoming the odds or whatever. So there's really not much to see here, because this is a scientific match that involves Nikolai Volkoff, a guy who, on the For Your Consideration podcast, number 10, which is on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, if you scroll back about a week, you'll find it. It was said, I don't know if it was Dylan Hales or Will or who said it, they could not think of a single good Nikolai Volkoff match. And I was exercising at the time, and it really got me thinking. I thought, didn't he have a nice brawl with Jim Duggan? And then I remembered, oh yeah, that only lasted like 2.5 minutes. I was thinking in Mid-South. And just racking my brain, and no, not from a singles perspective can I think of a good Nikolai Volkoff match. I can think of matches that I've really enjoyed that he was a part of. The 20-man tag match at Survivor Series 1988. But let's think about it here. Volkoff was barely in that match, and even then, he's one of 20 guys, so he's 5% of the match. This match against Kirshner here, he is 50% of the match, and the other 50% is high as a kite, I can only assume. So we're just waiting for Volkoff to cheat in some way, and it takes a while. And as a matter of fact, I had said that Corporal Kirshner, it takes him 420 in order for him to get warmed up, and I meant that as a joke. But sure enough, at the 4 minute and 10 second mark, or thereabouts in the match, Volkoff doesn't break clean at one point, and then ends up sort of hot-shotting or clotheslining Kirshner on the top rope, and he gets the pin for the 1-2-3 at the time of the match, 4 minutes and 22 seconds. So he was warmed up at the count of 1, was Kirshner, but he was so high that he forgot to kick out. So Corporal, he does get his heat back after the match, and I'm not saying that he got his heat back to light his joint or anything like that. He drives the Sheik and Volkoff from the ring, dispatches them to the back as the two heels are grabbing their head, but then they raise their arms in a token of victory. This was really totally nothing here. There would be a rematch at WrestleMania 2 that had a really bizarre finish with Blassie throwing in the cane and Corporal Kirshner intercepting it and hitting Volkoff with it himself to pick up the win in what was a flag match. So I guess it just meant he could, you know, wave the American flag after the match. The peace match, not entirely sure what was to be accomplished there. Fun fact, at the end of my wedding ceremony in 2010, after all the vows and all that, and my bride and I were to walk the aisle going in the other direction, that is the song that played, because I thought it would be a funny touch, and yes, it actually did pop the crowd on that day, 7 years ago. So we get footage here to redirect from discussion of a song played at my wedding to Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji hanging Ricky Steamboat, as a clip is shown of them hanging the dragon by some sort of strap over the top rope. And they have him actually tied to the top rope. Steamboat's got his finger in there to kind of, you know, keep it from doing real damage. Morocco and Fuji are interviewed. This is after they show Morocco kind of with a surfboard or something in that wave pool and have a bunch of women run towards him. Gotta be honest, never really thought of the Magnificent Morocco as a heartthrob, so it's kind of weird to see five bikini girls. I just think of him as a guy from Hawaii who is a little overgassed and always looks kind of fat and bloated for some reason. So yes, it is the team of Fuji Vice, and they're going to be taking on Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and the very busy Junkyard Dog. Now, my role in the wrestling podcast world, yes, I could crack wise about Fuji Vice or Morocco's laziness, although good old Will, his rant on that aforementioned For Your Consideration podcast on Don Morocco was really something else. I wish I had the timestamp of it so you could go right to it, but you should just listen to that whole podcast. Now, I could just point out, oh, Mr. Fuji's foibles, but I've talked about him many times before. But I do have to discuss one thing that Mr. Fuji said in this promo.
Mr. Fuji, what do you do with dogs in Japan?
Mr. Fuji?
In my country, we roast dogs, fried dogs, boiled dogs, junkyard dogs, and have these toys.
That's wrong.
Let's go.
My role in the wrestling podcast world is to call bullshit on something like that, where the stereotype of, oh, Japanese people like to eat dog meat. No, it's Korean people who like to eat dog meat, not the Japanese, okay? They are not all the same in East Asia. I know it's 1985, 86 we're talking about here, but you'd like to think that we could perhaps move past it, despite the Japan phobia that was gripping the United States around that time, for whatever reason. What, because we weren't making VCRs in the United States anymore? Well, guess what? They're now not making any VCRs in Japan either. So, there. As for this dog thing, alright, let me tell you something about dogs in Japan, okay? And I'm just gonna read it straight out here. The consumption of dog meat is not a feature of modern Japanese culture. There is a belief in Japan that certain dogs have special powers in their religion of Shintoism and Buddhism. Dog meat was consumed in Japan until 675 AD, when Emperor Tenmu decreed a prohibition on its consumption during the 4th through 9th months of the year. Normally, a dog accompanied the emperor for battle, so it was believed that eating a dog gave emperors bad luck. In Japanese shrines, certain animals are worshipped, such as dogs, as it is believed they will give people a good luck charm called Komenu. Animals are described as good luck in scrolls and kakemono during the Kofun period. It goes on and on and on. My point here is Japanese people do not eat dogs. In fact, the Japanese people are, much like Americans, willing to dress up their dogs in sweaters and make them wear horrible clothing. They're just like we are in this part of the world. So, people are people, as a 1980s band once said. So, yeah. Hate Fuji for being devious, not because he's Japanese. And don't let him peddle a line of bullcrap about the Japanese people, because he doesn't know any better, okay? He's lying to you, which I suppose makes him an effective heel. So we go back to Jesse, and he has an unfortunate turn of phrase.
What about all this gobbledygook, Jesse, about boiled dog, fried dog, all that stuff?
Well, I'll tell you what, McMahon, in Japan, they even eat raw dog.
Raw dog?
Let's just move past the fact that Vince McMahon uses the term gobbledygook on WWF television for 5 years before the gobbledygooker was a thing at the 1990 Survivor Series. The term raw dog, hearing that on television. Now, I'm not that savvy. I am not exactly a man of the streets. I grew up in suburban Boston. But I know a few things. I've heard a few things here and there. So I know what raw dog means. So I'm going to tell you what it means in case you don't know. This is courtesy of the Urban Dictionary, the internet's greatest source for this sort of thing. Raw dog. To engage in sexual intercourse without the use of a condom. Could you please use it in a sentence? I blacked out and raw dogged my ex-boo last night. So there you have it, raw dog on WWF television. So Junkyard Dog, who is just about cooked as a performer at this point, so he's well done. And Ricky Steamboat taking on Magnificent Morocco and Mr. Fuji. Fuji Vice was a humorous skit, in my opinion, but without going too far into it, none of them were, you know, fall down funny or anything like that. I mean, maybe I need to take another look at it. It's just that I don't think they're quite as funny as they're recalled, at least in some circles. JYD has a promo here again, and for the second time, I can't understand a word he says.
You know me and Gene, these guys, man, have been doing everything they could to Ricky, but also to a lot of people, they're seeing the bad trends in the wrestling world. They're bringing away, setting some type of trend that's wanting the kids to follow them. But me and Gene, I don't like it. I know you don't want your kids to follow, and I'm going to try my best to help Ricky to do something about it.
All right, maybe that wasn't so bad, and perhaps it's a South Carolina thing. Since Jim Rice on Red Sox pre- and post-game shows up here in the New England area, when I do happen upon those, he talks in a very, very fast, rapid manner and a very similar accent to the Junkyard Dog. On the YouTube video, we get Another One Bites the Dust, which surprised me because the wrestling album had been out for a couple of months, and I figured Grab Them Cakes would join Junkyard Dog at that point going forward. But on the original, apparently they played Another One Bites the Dust, but it's dubbed over on the network by a very well-placed Another One Bites the Dust with arena effects. So it was one of their better dubbing jobs. And honestly, the dubbed version probably sounds more natural, because that was when you would have thought that he had the song, if you catch my drift there. I don't know. So we get the heels controlling this one early, with including a Mr. Fuji body slam of Ricky Steamboat on the outside. It feels like Fuji body slamming a wrestler. He's a manager, but he's not quite a manager, because this is his second Saturday Night Main Event match. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, he's got that much shine. He's not a chicken shit sort of manager. He's a little bit different from your Jimmy Hart's and those other guys. The dog misses a falling headbutt here, and the heels, as I said, definitely in control. But we get a particularly crappy arm drag by the Junkyard Dog as sort of a comeback, but that doesn't really go anywhere. Fuji hits the kind of, almost where he looks like he's falling down accidentally, but he headbutts Junkyard Dog in the nuts, which, that'll take some of the starch out of you, Jess. But Morocco misses the SD Jones Memorial Charge, and eventually we get the Dragon into the ring as the House of Fire. So you would have figured that Steamboat would have been the guy playing Face in Peril here, and Junkyard Dog would have come in and been the House of Fire at the end. But no, we mix it up a little, and he slingshots Morocco into Mr. Fuji, and then we get the flying body press onto Morocco, but Fuji comes in and breaks up the pin. Then a quick tag to the Junkyard Dog, and Fuji is the legal man in there at this time. A headbutt, and that's pretty much it. It's all over. 1, 2, 3, and I just like, okay, that is what it is. At this point on the East Coast, it's about 12:55 in the morning, so, you know, a quick match, didn't run too long, nothing particularly memorable. You would like to think that Ricky Steamboat could be in a better spot, but honestly, by keeping Steamboat towards the end, you're keeping people like me and you, the serious wrestling fan, oh, I want to see Ricky Steamboat work, so put them there at the end. Those people will stay up, and hopefully some of the casual fans will come along for the ride. Jesse and Vince wrap things up by disagreeing on what the true highlight of the show was. Vince believes that it is Hulk Hogan's successful defense against Terry Funk, whereas Jesse believes that it was him leading his team to victory, stepping out of the broadcast booth, unlike Brent Musburger and Vin Scully and all those guys. So they'll just have to agree to disagree. But what we can all agree on is a robust edition of YouTube Comment Theater. And this is probably the most robust one yet, because as I am recording this, there are 195 comments on this video, which I think might be more than all the other videos that I've done combined. Needless to say, Saturday Night's Main Event is a rather popular video if it sneaks through onto YouTube. So I have no idea how I can possibly sort this out. So I'm just sorting it by top comments, and some of these have years ago now. Mr. Chopsticks says, and by the way, very racist caricature for Mr. Chopsticks here, as you can probably figure out what that might be. 1985, what a great time to be alive. You know, there's an actual exercise that I had. I like to ask dumb questions, like, of my friends to really kind of make them think, like, which one of the outsiders was your favorite? Like, who had your favorite career? Was it Rob Lowe? Was it Patrick Swayze? But another question I like to ask is, you could transport yourself into any year in your lifetime, and you can live it as you are right now, your current age. What year would you want to go to? And I think of it, of course, as a wrestling fan, and 1985 would certainly be high on the list. I'd like to go to 1984, mainly so I could go to other territories and just say, hey, you know, enjoy this now while while it lasts. Also 1989, because you get the tail end of some territories, but also the great in-ring year for WCW, NWA, and also a lot of fun stuff going on in the WWF, as I've covered in certain previous episodes. Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, I don't think it's the same one, says, that random walk of life in the beginning and using Obsession by Animotion. LOL, good times. Well, you know, I do like my commercial music on here, and yeah, Walk of Life, as I went into earlier, and Obsession by Animotion is a great day. It just makes me think of Hogan walking to the ring and the whole Saturday Night Main Event intro. Brent Sexy says, LOL, Piper tried to cop a feel on Elizabeth. And yes, that was from the earlier Saturday Night's Main Event from November of 1985, where Piper's hand got an awful bit close to her ass. But I do think that Piper and Savage were friends, so I don't know. Savage was always just extremely paranoid. David G. writes, that was when Vince pretended to be just a commentator. And you know what? I kind of miss those days. Yeah, sure, the Mr. McMahon character might have made them untold millions of dollars with the feud with Austin, but don't you miss simple Vince, who was just the huckster on commentary who didn't call moves and was overly excited for everything and would overly laugh with that glorious fake laugh that I played a little bit earlier? Jason Bro says, now this is wrestling. Nowadays, wrestling has lost its momentum. I miss the WWF in the 80s and 90s. Great matches. Well, no shit, Sherlock. That's why I'm doing this podcast here that's literally been all 80s and 90s. I haven't even touched the year 2000, and I haven't gone to 1979 yet, although I do have a few 1970s shows out there on YouTube that I may consider doing at some point in the future. Jonathan Turbide writes, allowing Corporal Kirshner to cut a promo equals very dangerous mission. And yes, for all the reasons that I have outlined. Yeah, Corporal Kirshner, not exactly a really good interview there. Greedy D says, Malenko, referring to Dean Malenko, looked 40 years old on the day he was born. He definitely looks younger here than he did in his late 90s heyday in WCW. So he doesn't fully suffer from what I'll call Arn Anderson disease, where you are perpetually 42 years old. Or, of course, the next step of that is Sparky Anderson disease, where you perpetually look 67 years old. Also, that was a disease that was also contracted by Jim Leland. Apparently, that went around in baseball managerial circles back in the day. Mario Cavett says, Jesse was a great worker, more so than Bobby the Brain Heenan gave him credit for. Well, you know what? I'm not even going to go that far. I like Jesse in the ring more than most people. It might be because I like Jesse going in and didn't really have to tolerate him as a in-ring wrestler because I didn't start watching until after he was long retired. But I wouldn't use the word great worker in terms of Jesse. I'll just put it that way. James Bonin says, one of the few times Jesse wrestled after his blood clot scare. His last match was later the next year against Tito Santana and lost on a countout when he left the ring. Now, he and Piper did have a tag match at a house show against the Orient Express, which was used in the pilot and only episode of Tag Team. And of course, that is what I was referring to earlier, that Piper and Ventura making a good tag team. That whole pilot episode of that show is on YouTube. James Perrone says, those were the days when wrestling was so red hot, SNL was canceled for a week just for this show. Brings back great memories, and now watching it some 30-odd years later, emotion as many of those childhood heroes who were larger than life are gone now. Andre, Stud, Piper, Savage, Liz, Fuji, Albano, JYD, and Moolah, just to name a few. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. I could go on and on and on because there's so many more, but a lot of the comments really don't say too much of anything. I do not have a show yet for next week, although on my Facebook page I posted on my wall or whatever. So I'm still trying to figure out Facebook. I don't know how it works, whatever. But I suggested that because it's a fortnight of funk and I post a show on a Wednesday night, Thursday morning, then I post on the next Wednesday night, Thursday morning. The third one would also be within those 2 weeks because it would be exactly 2 weeks after the first show. So I could squeeze in a third Terry Funk show. But of course, I'm open to suggestions. Somebody actually suggested one that I have in the queue already, and I do have an extensive YouTube list, and I should probably get to those before they get pulled off of YouTube, and I would have to go to my strategic emergency reserve at that point. So yes, some point late Wednesday next week or early Thursday morning, I will have another show. I don't know what it'll be on, but I'm sure it'll be pretty good. Just rest assured, it's going to be fine. So do tune in then for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Funk is.
I blacked out and raw dogged my ex boo last night.